Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
Support for On Point and the following message come from Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Home plays a big role in your life. That's why Quicken Loans created Rocket Mortgage. It lets you apply simply and understand the entire mortgage process fully, so you can be confident that you're getting the right mortgage for you. To get started, go to rocketmortgage.com/onpoint.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Ray Suarez, and this is On Point. In 1899, scientists and writers set off on a floating university to the wilds of Alaska, where they encountered strange, beautiful lands already affected by climate change. More than a century later, journalist Mark Adams, who searched for Atlantis and explored Machu Picchu, was up for the challenge of retracing their steps. On his 3,000-mile expedition through America's last great frontier, he met interesting people and bears and saw firsthand how much the vast Alaskan landscape is melting. This hour on Point, a journey around wild Alaska. You can join us on air or online. Have you taken a journey on Alaska's Inside Passage? What struck you about the place? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me now from New York is journalist and author Mark Adams. He's written the New York Times bestsellers Meet Me in Atlantis and Turn Right at Machu Picchu. His latest book is Tip of the Iceberg, My 3,000-Mile Journey Around Wild Alaska, The Last Great American Frontier, just out this month. Mark Adams, welcome back to On Point.
Thanks for having me, Ray.
Were there points when you were retracing this very daunting expedition of 1899 where you thought, who told me this was a good idea?
Definitely. Prime among them was the morning I woke up just before 4, which is, of course, past daybreak in Alaska in the summer, and confronted what I thought were two seaweed-covered rocks. And then the rocks started moving, and I realized that they were actually a pair of brother bears, and they were very interested in me as well.
This is a place that's still full of harsh, dangerous environments, a place where you can still die when you're poking around. And even with the benefit of modern insulation and waterproof material and lightweight equipment and so on, it's a tough place to get around.
It very much can be. You know, I mean, Alaska is a place where the veneer of civilization could be peeled back pretty quickly. And part of that is because of its crazy topography. It's enormous. It's bigger than the next three states combined. And the easiest way to get around for a lot of people is to just take a boat from place to place. Or in my case, I took the Alaska Marine Ferries, which are sort of like the Greyhound of Alaska and will take you from town to town up the Inside Passage and then out towards the Aleutians.
Even that takes a bit of planning, though. I mean, at several junctures in the book, you say, if I miss this, I'm going to be stuck here for 2 days.
Or, you know, it's true.
You miss something by 15 minutes and you're you're sunk.
It's not the Acela from, New York to Boston or D.C. You miss your connection, and it could be 5 days. It could be 2 weeks. Some of these more remote towns, even in the summer, towns like Yakutat, which is surrounded by 100 miles of wilderness in every direction, is considered by many the most deserted town, isolated town in the United States. The boat comes through twice a week. You know, people come down to the dock to buy hamburgers off of the boat, because that's a special treat. That's how isolated these places are.
What was the original 1899 trip, and what attracted your attention about it?
Well, what was interesting about it was that trips up the Inside Passage had actually become popular because of the writings of John Muir, founder of the Sierra Club, now known as like the eco-prophet, who's the father of the national parks. And people went up to see the same things now that they do now. They wanted to see glaciers. They wanted to see bears. They wanted to see incredible mountains. So, E.H. Harriman spent the previous summer, 1898, checking out every inch of track on the railroad he had just purchased, which left him exhausted. And his doctor said, you need to take the summer of 1899 off. Harriman, being Harriman, said, okay, let's kill two birds with one stone. I'm going to refit one of the steamships I own as a gigantic luxury yacht, and I'm going to have so much space left over that I can invite 24 of America's top natural scientists, writers, and artists. And they will sort of spend half the time entertaining themselves and my family and spend half the time making new discoveries, because Alaska at this time is still terra incognita. You know, these scientists expected to be, you know, having a nice dinner and then getting up the next morning, going down to the beach and you know, discovering six new species of mollusks or something. But what I found out was that once they got there, they realized that Alaska, which was just becoming known as the last frontier because the American West frontier was closing, was already in jeopardy environmentally. You know, they were pouring cyanide into the water supply for gold mining. The wild salmon were almost fished out because the canning companies were stealing as much as they could. And the seals, which were the original reason that white people came to Alaska anyway and a big reason why America bought it from Russia, were close to extinction. So, you know, it was a much richer story than it looked like on the surface.
And, you know, it encapsulates that part of it, that 19th century attitude that some places was just sort of bottomless, that you could just keep hunting and keep fishing and keep trapping and there'd always be more. But then even once you realize that there's a limit to it all, you decide, all right, well, if there is a limit, I'm going to be the one to catch the last salmon.
Absolutely. And that's something that they confronted in the town of Cordova, which at that time was a salmon canning capital. And companies were saying, you know, I'm just going to stretch a mile wide net across this entire river to keep my competitors from getting any salmon. It was basically a salmon eradication program, in effect. And, you know, 90 years later, of course, Cordova is the place where the Exxon Valdez disaster happened. So they have a long history of ecological problems in that area.
That E.H. Harriman, he's emblematic of the 19th century dabbler, the amateur, but amateur in the best good old fashioned sense of the word. People who do things out of love rather than as a professional vocation. A gazillionaire in that pre-federal income tax world. He could actually snap his fingers and make some of the best-known scientists of his time show up.
Oh, absolutely. He got this idea in March, and they sailed before the end of May. So he collected these scientists. You know, John Muir is in the San Francisco area. He's looking at, you know, Yosemite area. Everybody else is on the East Coast, and he's getting these people on trains and getting them out west and getting, you know, what are your desires? What are your menu needs? What kind of scientific equipment do you need? You know, this boat had like milk cows on it so they could have fresh milk every morning. The logistics were just amazing. But that's what Harriman was famous for. You know, he was famous as a man who could get things done.
If you're just joining us, I'm talking to author Mark Adams, whose latest is Tip of the Iceberg, My 3,000-Mile Journey Around Wild Alaska, The Last Great American Frontier. I was interested to see, Mark, that just as Native people struggle for a place in the modern Alaska today, there were very much in evidence, even as early as the end of the 19th century, a similar struggle where the Harriman expedition confronted what could only be called the wreckage of Native societies, still reeling from their contacts with Russians from further west and Brits and Americans from further east.
Absolutely. I mean, you know, the smallpox and other viruses that came with the Russians when they began sealing in the 1740s absolutely devastated the Native populations, especially of the coast. You know, some of them lost up to 80% of their people in the matter of a generation. It was total chaos. You know, in the Inside Passage, the primary Native group there are the Tlingit. And, you know, to this day, they're still trying to recover from things that happened in the 1890s, because when Alaska, you know, became a territory in 1867, they said, okay, white Americans in here can have rights. Russians can stick around and become Americans and have rights. But Natives, you basically have no rights.
So it was just a replay of some of the things that happened on the lower 48?
It was. It was worse in the 19th century, but Alaska's natives played a very long game And when oil showed up in the 1960s, they knew they had a very strong hand to play and said, look, you guys want to build a pipeline? We're going to hold this thing up in court forever unless we get a lot of land and a lot of money. And they did. And they you know, after almost 100 years, they finally got some compensation.
We're going to talk about this later in the program, but I was also interested in the sort of tug of war between preserving things that are pristine and wonderful and gorgeous and exploiting the hell out of them. And
right.
often those two desires at present in the same person.
Yeah, yeah. You know, that's the great tension of Alaska is the desire to go up and, you know, see wild animals in their most wild habitat. And at the same time, in the case of Harriman, the original reason why he wanted to take the trip was to shoot a Kodiak brown bear. He wanted to shoot one of the biggest bears in the world so he could, you know, have his head on the wall when he got home.
Which sort of turned off John Muir, didn't it?
Well, John Muir always had sort of what we might call animist beliefs. He believed that, all of God's creatures. And, you know, he was raised a very hardcore fundamentalist Christian, and some of that seeped into his thinking. But he was also very much in the transcendentalist mode like Thoreau and Emerson, and he believed that every living thing had some form of soul. So when, you know, hunters aboard the boat, it was called the Elder, when they would get off the Elder with their guns and say, okay, we're going to go off and shoot a bear, Muir would occasionally, because he knew the area better than anybody else, lead them on sort of a wild goose chase.
Did Harriman get his bear?
He did eventually. When they got to Kodiak Island, which is an enormous island south of where Anchorage is, he did. It's kind of a sad story because he shot a mother and his assistant shot the cub. And when they got there, they realized these weren't even very impressive bears. But he was pleased. He'd done what he came out to do.
Later on in the program, we'll talk about your own run-in with bears and some of the real dangers involved. I mean, you certainly don't go up and pet them. We're discussing Mark Adams' 3,000-mile trek through Alaska in Tip of the Iceberg, Wild Alaska, the Last Great American Frontier. You can join the conversation. Alaskans, former Alaskans, we want to hear from you. What should we know about that great state? I'm Ray Suarez. This is On Point.
Support for On Point and the following message come from Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Chances are you're confident when it comes to your work, your hobbies, and your life. Rocket Mortgage gives you that same level of confidence when it comes to buying a home or refinancing your existing home loan. Rocket Mortgage is simple, allowing you to fully understand all the details and be confident you're getting the right mortgage for you. To get started, go to rocketmortgage.com/onpoint. Equal housing lender, licensed in all 50 states. NMLS consumeraccess.org, number 3030.
On Bullseye, I talk with people who make amazing work. Greta Gerwig, Errol Morris, A$AP Ferg. The conversations are real and funny, and they take you somewhere unexpected. Find Bullseye with Jesse Thorne on NPR One or wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Ray Suarez. We're discussing Alaska, America's last great frontier. You can join the conversation. What do you make of the Interior Department's announcement that it might allow bear hunting in Alaska? How will this affect conservation efforts? Follow us on Twitter. Find us on Facebook. At On Point Radio. My guest today is Mark Adams. His latest book is Tip of the Iceberg, My 3,000-Mile Journey Around Wild Alaska, the Last Great American Frontier, just out this month. Alaska is a top five summer travel destination this year, according to data from the AAA. Millions of people will embark on cruises through Alaska's Inside Passage just in the coming weeks. Here's an ad from the Princess Cruise Lines attempting to capture the appeal.
I've seen wonders all around the world, but what I see here never ceases to amaze me. Change. I see it in their eyes. It happens when people connect with nature, with culture, with each other.
Mark Adams, it's not oil prospectors. It's not people panning for gold. It's people on great big boats who are now a big feature of the Alaska ecosystem, right?
More than a million of them will be up there in June, July, and August this year, Ray.
It's a hard to believe number, really, given how many people fit on an individual boat. They must be lined up on that inner passage.
Well, because it's so vast, you don't get the sense that there are all these other tourists here until you pull into the main stops, which are Ketchikan, Juneau, and Skagway. And then you get there, and it's like, you know, Paul Bunyan just knocked down five giant sequoias, and those are the ships that are waiting at the dock. It's incredible to see these huge ships, you know, disgorging their passengers into these small towns, sometimes increasing the population 10 times for 8 hours and then pulling out at night.
With no small impact on what life in those towns is like.
Well, in a lot of places like Ketchikan or Skagway, you know, that's probably the main business at this point. It certainly is in Skagway. You know how kids used to go off to Alaska in the summer, college kids, and they would say, you know, I'm going to make money canning salmon or, you know, doing something in the lumberyard. Now they go up there and they work in the tourism business in towns like that. And, you know, it's a 3-month job and then they go home.
Frank is with us now from Valdosta, Georgia. Frank, welcome.
Hi, Ray. Following the directions of your the person who received your call, I was prompted to call you because my wife and I take small groups, two or three couples at a time, and travel throughout by vehicle throughout the state of Alaska for 6 or 7 weeks every summer, and I'll be there the entire month of July. My wife will be there 2 or 3 weeks longer, but I have to get back to teach college in the fall semester. And my comment is that in the 15 or 18 years that we've been doing this, we have taken, I would estimate, between 22 and 28, 29 different groups, very small groups. I do the driving. We fly into Anchorage, get a rental car in Palmer, and specific to today's discussion, even in the less than 20 years that we've been doing this, I can bear witness to the degradation of glaciers, Portage Glacier at Whittier, Root Glacier up in Denali, the glacier at Kennecott Mine has receded noticeably, Columbia Glacier in the Prince William Sound, which we see, we take groups out of Valdez and go on a wildlife viewing and glacier viewing cruise. We've seen some degradation in Kodiak, the glacier in Cordova, Childs Glacier, which is undercut by a river, which is 25 miles out of the little town of Cordova. So we have witnessed all of this two dozen times or more with various groups of people that we take to Alaska on very personalized guided tours.
Frank, thanks a lot for your call. Mark Adams, you give us a chapter and verse comparing what you see in Alaska's glaciers with what the Harriman expedition saw. So we have, in effect, in your book, 116 years of effect to go along with Frank's intelligence from the ground from various parts of the state.
Well, because oil is so powerful in Alaska, there are a lot of people who are very invested in confusing the issue about whether Alaska's glaciers are growing or receding. Now, there are a few, fewer than 1%, that are actually growing, and that's because they're moving ice and snow that actually fell before Columbus crossed the Atlantic Ocean in 1492. It takes that long for the ice to get all the way to its terminus at the water's edge, and those are tidewater glaciers. And if you look at something like the Muir Glacier, named for John Muir in Glacier Bay, in 1899, that had a 300-foot-high face. And since then, it has melted back 30 miles. It doesn't touch the water. It doesn't come near the water. You cannot see it from the water anymore. So a lot of these glaciers are in what they call catastrophic retreat.
During a visit to Alaska in 2015, then-President Obama used melting glaciers to explain the impact man-made climate change has had on the environment. Former Alaska Governor Sarah Palin said this in response.
Obama was up here looking at, say, the glaciers and pointing out a glacier that was receding. Well, there are other glaciers, though, that are growing up here, and he didn't highlight that.
The glacier she's referring to is the Hubbard Glacier, which has expanded. is that a rare one, though, Mark? Are there many expanding glaciers in Alaska today?
No. And there are two kinds. There are the mountain glaciers, and then there are the famous glaciers that everybody sees from the cruise ship, the tidewater glaciers. Those are the ones that calve and splash into the water and everybody claps. 99% of the tidewater glaciers are in retreat right now. The Hubbard is growing. There's a glacier called the Johns Hopkins that seems to be growing a little bit. But those glaciers tend to have extremely high mountains, and Alaska has the 10 tallest mountains in the United States within its borders. Extremely high mountains and extremely high precipitation. You know, the Inside Passage is rainier than actually Hawaii. So those two things coming together, you get a lot of snow that packs into a lot of ice that can keep the glacier growing for a while. Will it keep going forever? Probably not.
We'll go next to the birthplace of the United States Coast Guard, Newburyport, Massachusetts. Danielle, welcome to the program.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Welcome.
I'm originally from Portsmouth, New Hampshire. I'm a teacher, and I wanted to have my Henry David Thoreau experience. I'm an English teacher, and I ended up in a one-room log cabin in Fairbanks, Alaska. I had an outhouse, had to lug my own water, and there I learned something very important, that in every great challenge, you know, having an outhouse is nothing I grew up with. Inside every great challenge, there's really opportunities. If I didn't have that outhouse, I know I would have seen a lot fewer northern lights. That's not really why I'm calling. I ended up teaching in a little tiny village in southeast Alaska, the Florida Keys of Alaska. And it's the village of Heideberg. And I ended up getting adopted into the tribe, and I have two Native Alaskan children. I was in the village for quite a while, but I did move to Florida, maybe to thaw out. Anyway, I just came back a few months ago after being gone for several years, and there was a remarkable difference. And climate change is real. The entire village of Kivalina had to move their village. In Native villages, there's something really special, and people that are into sustainability and taking care of our planet and each other realize that Native cultures have been doing it right all along. The village that I came from was incorporated in 1922. Three villages, traditional Haida villages, had to be dismantled. Missionaries were stealing the Native kids off the beach while they were just playing, doing their day. Their parents would see them going off, you know, being kidnapped. So in order to get this practice to stop, they decided that they would subvert their culture. They would take white men's last names, and they kept their culture alive through song and dance. The language is almost gone. We're really trying to hold on to it, but our last native speaker that's fluent, he's in his 90s. I guess here's one thing that I wanted to share. The way that a chief would attain status, you know, here in Western culture, a lot of people, not everybody, but some people think, you know, it's about gaining. How much can we keep in terms of what money can buy? How great's your car? How many TVs? Do you have the newest iPhone? But a chief there would show status, not by keeping, but how much you could give. It's just incredible. They would give a potlatch, you know, accumulate wealth. It would show how much power you had, because you could say to your warriors, okay, I want you guys, you 20, go out and get deer. You guys over here, go get some fish. You guys make the baskets, et cetera. And, you know, it was a real harmony between the people and the land and the sea. They made everything from what the trees could give. You know, it's really sad that today so many of the villages, they're beautiful places, and there's always giving, always giving. The islands that I lived on, Prince of Wales, it's as large as Puerto Rico, but Puerto Rico has millions of people. This island, only 5,000.
Wow. Danielle, thanks a lot for your call from Newburyport, Mass. I'd like to bring another voice into the conversation. Joining me now from Nome, Alaska, is Richard Benville. He's been mayor of Nome since 2015 and owns a tourism company in the city. He's also a former Broadway chorus member. Richard Benville, welcome to On Point.
Hello, how are you, Ray? It's nice to talk to you.
Nice
to hear your voice again, too.
Hi, Richard. Nice to hear your voice, too.
I talk to very few people around the Arctic Circle, Mayor, so thanks a lot for joining us. What got you up to Nome in the first place?
Quickly, I drank a career away in New York. I lived on the Upper West Side for many, many years, and I simply drank the career away that I had desired all my life. And I went to Alaska. My brother was a stockbroker here in Merrill Lynch in Anchorage. And I met a man named Alan Gallant, who happened to be New York, from New York and Jewish, and he said, I like your style. And so I went off to Barrow, Alaska. Today, you've gone back to its original name, Utqiagvik, at the very top of the world. And not to slight the native people at all, half my town, more than half my town, is native Alaskan, so they're my constituents, hello, Central. But I sold freezers to the Eskimos, like my grandmother once told me I did. But that's a cheap shot at a people and a culture that is absolutely magnificent, and I'm so thrilled to be a part of it these last 40 years.
I recommend that people pull out a map of the United States and take a look at where Nome is. It is both far away from a lot of other things in Alaska and pretty close to the North Pole. The village of Shishmaref, Alaska, not too far from Nome, held a vote in 2016 to decide whether to relocate due to the effects of climate change. Over the past 35 years, the town lost up to 3,000 feet of land to coastal erosion. In the vote, 94 people favored relocation, 78 people wanted to try to protect in place. But the town is awaiting appeals for federal funds to make the relocation happen. Here's Esau Sinuk, speaking with All Things Considered a couple of years ago on the importance of moving.
Shishmaref will be underwater within the next 3 decades, and if we do not do anything, we'll have to move to another city like Nome or Kotzebue or Anchorage, and not many people will move to the same place, so that means our unique dialect of Inupiaq Eskimo language, our unique Eskimo dancing, our unique gospel singing translated in Inupiaq, all that will soon die out if we do not move as a community.
Mayor, have you been getting people who are fleeing coastal erosion coming to Nome?
Well, fleeing is a word that sounds a lot more immediate than in fact it is, but it is happening, yes. And Mr. Sinuk, whom I know, it's 180 miles away from us, and I've been to Shishmaref a number of times. And the answer is yes. They can't protect it because form outside on the in the ocean used to protect the shore from winter storms, ergo the erosion of which he spoke. Today the ice is thinner, breaks up, forms earlier, breaks up later. It's a very different world up here, so the protection is not there. And it's not just Shishmaref. We have about 5 or 6 villages on what I call the list that eventually will have to move because of climate change and ocean levels rising.
Mark Adams, the villages that we're talking about, the ones near Nome, are quite some distance away from where our caller in Newburyport, Massachusetts, was living in southeast Alaska. It's a vast distance, but it doesn't matter. All these different environments are seeing these effects.
Yeah, well, to put the distance in perspective, I think I estimated it was the same as from Jacksonville, Florida, to San Francisco, roughly. From the spot where you enter Alaska in the Inside Passage and the southern end of the panhandle there to Nome. Shishmaref, Kivalina, Newtok, there are all these towns that are facing similar situations. And basically what they're going to have to do is build an entire new infrastructure and move the entire town. And this is going to cost, I've seen estimates of up to $200 million per town. And there just isn't much funding for this right now. And, it is, as Richard said, a sort of a slow motion tragedy, but it is a tragedy and it is coming, and we don't know when it's coming.
And I think, not to interrupt you, Mark, but to give a sense of perspective to your listeners, Alaska has, and I was curious to hear the lady who with the Coast Guard speak, Alaska has half, more than half, of the coastline of the entire United States of America. Mm-hmm. In on its shores. So I live about 100 miles from the Bering Strait, And everybody says, oh, yeah, well, Russia and America almost meet. Well, that is a now whole different bag now because of climate change. Our town is in the process of, and we're beginning, you know, almost there to begin construction on an expansion of our port to a deep water draft port because of what is happening, the accessibility of the Arctic Ocean, and this makes a lot of people shudder. But it is the world, and it is the way the world is going, and it is with great concern that I, as mayor, who's a politician who looks forward, as many do, including Native Alaskans, to the improvements in the economies, etc. But there is also subsistence hunting. That's 50 miles of water that only two ways to get from the Atlantic to the Pacific Ocean in the Northern Hemisphere. One of them is the Panama Canal, and the other is the Bering Strait.
We're discussing the changing face of Alaska. That's Mayor Richard Benville joining us from Nome near the Arctic Circle. You can join the conversation. Do you support drilling in the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge? What, if anything, should be done to combat climate change in Alaska? Mayor Benville joins us along with Mark Adams, author of Tip of the Iceberg. I'm Ray Suarez. This is On Point.
There's nothing like a movie theater on a hot day, and there's nothing like a good show you can binge watch with a cold glass of lemonade. Summer is the perfect time to find your next favorite thing, and Pop Culture Happy Hour is here to help. Find us on the NPR One app or wherever you get podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Ray Suarez. We're talking about how our changing climate is affecting Alaska's landscape, among other things. You can join the conversation. What do you make of towns needing to relocate due to rising sea levels? Can you see that happening where you live? What should be done? My guests today are Mark Adams. His latest book is Tip of the Iceberg, My 3,000-Mile Journey Around Wild Alaska, The Last Great American Frontier, and Richard Benville, Mayor of Nome, Alaska. We'll go next to New Orleans, Louisiana. Andrew, welcome to On Point.
Hi, Ray.
Hi.
I'm certainly concerned with rising coastal oceans, the impact it could have on New Orleans. But I had the good fortune of visiting and going fishing in Kenai on the Kenai River during the salmon season. And it reminded me of a Mardi Gras because the Seward Highway was bumper to bumper, like a parade of RVs. Everybody was partying and, you know, just trash. People were just fishing and partying and just going nuts the whole time, like it was Mardi Gras down up there. And
what time of year was this, Andrew?
This was in, in like the salmon season. I think it was in May or June. It was anyway, my mom had just passed away, and I went there with my older brother and never went anywhere else but just around Kenai. And the river itself looks like milk because it's coming off of a glacier. It's really amazing river. And, of course, the fishermen, the ones who pilot the boats and stuff, know their stuff. But I just couldn't believe the amount of people that were on this road or in these campsites or partying 24 hours. It was just crazy. And it reminded me of New Orleans in Mardi Gras. And, of course, we're talking about coastal erosion. Well, you know, New Orleans is it's near and dear to my heart. And
Kenai is lucky or perhaps unlucky that it's in pretty easy proximity to Anchorage, and Anchorage is the big airport, it's the big population. So Kenai Peninsula is a place that's pretty easy to get to from the place in Alaska that's heavily populated. But would Mark Adams, Andrew, have been seeing outsiders or people who come from the state and are glad the thaw has finally come and want to kick out the jams a little bit?
Well,
whether they're outsiders, capital O, as they say in Alaska, or whether they are Alaska residents, the thing about Alaska is you pretty much have to pack all your fun into the period between Memorial Day and Labor Day, because depending on what part of the state you're in, you know, winter can start arriving as early as late August. So what he may have been seeing was irrational exuberance based on trying to get as much fun in as you could in a short period of time. But he is right about the beauty of the Kenai Peninsula and that sort of milky water from the glaciers, because even though climate change is very much occurring, there are places in Alaska like Gustavus near Glacier Bay, and Glacier Bay is absolutely phenomenally beautiful, where the land is rising every year, 2 inches, I believe, because so much ice is melting and so much new soil is being formed by the receding of the glaciers and the silt that they're creating new land. Some guy out there, I think, started a 9-hole golf course out of land that he had just reclaimed from the water.
We're going to go to Malone, New York next. It's tucked up near the Canadian border. So I guess, you know, since just Canada is between Malone and Alaska, you're pretty close, Wayne, aren't you?
Hi, Ray.
Hi.
Yes, close if I have the right flight. what I want to talk about is interior Alaska. 22 years ago, my wife and I purchased land on the edge of Denali Park. Interestingly, this was land that had been subdivided by a homesteader, and the homesteader put in a covenant in the deed that prevented the cutting of spruce. There was virtually no spruce at that time, and I guess, you know, the idea was if there are not many spruce, we want to save them. In the 22 years since we've been spending summers there, the spruce have erupted. I'm looking right now at a picture of our cabin, and if I were to go to that same place, this was taken 15 years ago, that same spot on the land, which is only about 200 feet from the cabin, I wouldn't be able to see the cabin because of the growth of the spruce. And I don't think that everybody realizes there's some subtle changes that are going on other than just the glacial change and the sea ice change. And the big impact I see in the long run is that the original landscape for many years in this area was lichen, a tundra landscape, that's gradually changing to a taiga landscape. Well, the caribou numbers are dependent on lichens. So it's really a change in the landscape, which is, in the long term, probably going to impact even what people will see when they like to go into Denali Park, which is a major tourist destination for those that travel to Alaska.
When a place changes from a lichen-strewn landscape to one that can actually support coniferous trees, Mayor Benville, that's as Wayne is illustrating in his call, that's a pretty significant change. It's going to change the way of life if the caribou stop coming, as he mentioned. The hunting patterns, where people go, what they come to see, a lot of things are probably going to have to be renegotiated. Are you seeing effects of those kind in your part of the state?
Yes. They say that the Arctic and the subarctic and the, you see climate change results up faster than anywhere, and it's so true.
Two times as fast as the rest of the United States. Sorry to interrupt,
yes,
Richard, but
no, exactly.
Twice as fast.
It's hard to tell climate change when you're in a Brazilian rainforest. It's not very difficult at all when you live on the tundra. The gentleman was absolutely right. We are famous for our birds, and right now we're coming into the middle of our birding, May 15th to June 15th. I was down at Safety Sound yesterday, last evening, and the birds are amazing. I also looked at the calendar, and it's about 2 weeks early. The Arctic terns that come up from Antarctica are earlier. My garden that I go have to do everything above and raised beds, my snapdragons are blooming almost 3 weeks later. So the answer is that climate change is here. Accessibility of different areas, and it is, like you said, a great challenge to the people that live here, including an old gypsy from New York, because I see it, and I see how it affects my people and our people, and I am one of our people. I am not a native of Alaskan by any stretch, but I see the changes in my friend Boogles. Johnson was out hunting Ugaruk because now the ice is gone. I'm looking at the ocean now, and there's no ice. You can't see any ice at all. And that's very early, and that is what is happening, and it is happening very quickly.
And when the plants change, the animals change. 2 years ago, I was in Sitka, and they said, you know, look, the berries came out 6 weeks early this year. The bears are eating so many berries, we don't think they're going to eat any salmon.
And the salmon, you know, the water temperature is rising. The ice is forming later. All of these things are happening. That affects what's living in the water. That affects the food chain. That affects everything. So the timing of when the salmon, we're about 6 weeks later than, say, the Anchorage area to get the salmon. We'll have salmon in August and the beginning of September. So it's, everything is changing, and one just has to learn. The Eskimo people have been adapting for 10,000 years. the Harriman Expedition number one began, Muir began to realize that, and there are people that are still adapting today. I learn from them every day.
But let me ask you, Mark, several junctures in the book, you illustrate how various natural effects were already underway and already being observed in 1899. So we have 119 years of adaptation since then. Right. Is an adaptation constant? Should we be that afraid of it?
Well, the thing about climate change that is scariest is the rate of acceleration. It seems to be accelerating at 10 times the rate that has ever been recorded in the ice cores that have been collected around the world, which go back, I think, 600,000 years or so. You know, the difference between 1899 and 2018 is that in 1899, you had people like John Muir, his friend George Bird Grinnell, who was sort of a mentor to Teddy Roosevelt. They could go to Alaska, they could see that things were going wrong, and they could come back to Washington, D.C. and talk to Teddy Roosevelt, who suddenly finds himself president of the United States. Great conservationist says, you know what, I am going to read these reports from the Harriman expedition and start setting aside all of these beautiful glacier-filled areas for future generations. So, you know, compare that to now where we have an administration that with its EPA is pulling back laws and regulations, is taking back land like Bear's Ears, and is even, you know, threatening to allow uranium mining near the Grand Canyon. So it's a very different situation.
Dayton, Ohio is next. Paul, welcome to the program.
Oh, hi. How you doing?
Okay.
I have some comments and also a question. I was stationed in the Air Force in Alaska from 1980 to 1983, and in about a week or so, I'm going to be heading back to Alaska. I've been in there about a month and, well, roughly 5 weeks. And I have a son who just became assigned to Alaska. He traveled there during the winter, which was kind of scary for us as parents. But anyway, I will just say that I'm looking forward to, hopefully I don't see too many changes. I also learned how to fly up there when I was stationed there. I learned how to fly a private airplane. And I'll tell you, the people who drive the roads there, there's only one road north to my recollection and one road south out of Anchorage. And so you really haven't seen Alaska until you see it from the air. And, you know, it's just an awesome place. And my son lives just at the foothills of the Chugach Mountains right there. And my question has to do with, does my son have any alarm or concern about living in a residential neighborhood so close to the Chugach that he has to be fearful still of bears? I remember we used to have to kind of look out and keep our eyes out so that we didn't become a bear meal. I'll take it from there.
Thanks a lot for your call, Paul. Mark Adams, your advice?
If you're in Alaska and it's not like January, you basically have to be ready to run into a bear at any time. You know, and they drill this into everybody's heads. If you watch the news in Alaska, you know, the categories are like, you know, news, sports, weather, maulings. because if you don't know, I compare it to being in New York City, and Richard will remember this, and learning how to get along with people on the subway. You know, you don't touch anybody. You don't stare at anybody. But nobody explains this to you. You just have to sort of figure it out on your own. You know, you have to know how to deal with bears, and you don't have to deal with brown bears versus black bears because their behavior is very different. You know, a brown bear will run at you as if it's pretending to attack. If a black bear is running at you, it probably wants to eat you. So you really have to be careful and know what you're dealing with. That said,
And both are drawn by residential areas, right? Because there's food, easy food.
They're both looking. They're both looking for food. Yeah. But you know, if in places where you're in a rural area, you know, the trash is going to be sealed up, you know, like a Brinks truck, and people carry bear spray when they go out on hikes and things like that. So it, you know, Alaskans know how to deal with them. The problem usually is when someone who does not know how to deal with them suddenly shows up and you know wants to like put honey on their kid's hand or something.
Let's stop in Marshville, North Carolina, where Hayes is standing by. Hayes, welcome to On Point.
Hi, Ray. The reason why I'm calling is I think it's a super bad idea to drill in the Alaska National Wildlife Refuge and also to do coal mining, all that stuff. There's always oil leaks. You know about the Valdez that happened, and every pipeline that goes through Alaska leaks at one point or another. The Keystone Pipeline just leaked 180,000 gallons of oil. There's a wildlife photographer out there. His name is Robert Glenn Ketchum. And there's also Fran Zlanting there, a group of photographers that belong to the League of Conservation Photographers. They do talks about the destruction that is happening up in Alaska all the time. They do very succinct photo essays and speeches about this. If anybody wants to check them out on the internet, they can. But all those watersheds that are in Alaska, if you drill up there and you leak oil or coal ash or whatever, it's all going to go down into the Sound and pollute one of the largest fisheries in the world.
Hayes, let me thank you for your call and turn that to my guests, because the price of oil per barrel is now rising and pretty high, higher than it's been in some time. Is that changing, Mayor Benville, the conversation around oil and its extraction in Alaska?
Well, it is. And one of the things that Alaska has done, it has really no choice, but what it did has done wrong is over the years it's placed this economy in, almost entirely on oil. And that's a bad thing to do because we need to diversify. Is it changing? Yes, it is. Is oil still necessary until we are able to, you know, transition into different forms of energy? Yes, there will be, there will be petroleum and petroleum products used for a long time to come. It's very difficult. One has to remember also that the people of Alaska, especially Native Alaskans, this is their, the resources, the land, everything about it is the legacy for their children. And we need to not only be careful about it, we need to be pragmatic enough to understand that the wealth of St. Prudhoe Bay has changed life primarily for the better for the Alaska natives of the North Slope. Atikusuk, Nuiksit, all of these villages have really good infrastructure, good schools, sewers, water, all of those things because of the development of Prudhoe Bay. It is one of the most difficult things to try to do both and to walk that fine line. But it has to be done. It will be done. We're an Arctic nation, and the Arctic nations of the far north are all facing these problems.
That's Mayor Richard Benville. He joined us from Nome, Alaska, along with Mark Adams, the author of Tip of the Iceberg. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
You can continue the conversation and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. Follow us on Twitter. Find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. On Point is produced by Anna Bowman, Brian Hardzinski, Eileen Imada, Stefano Kotsonis, Allison Poli, Catherine Proctor, Tanya Raleigh, Jeremy Relosa, and James Ross. Our executive producer is Karen Schiffman. I'm Ray Suarez. This is On Point.